He had a long, complicated title, but I simplified it, right? As my role as expert title writer.
Yeah, there was all kinds of things about tip cells and cell examine interactions and kidneys and corals. And he said, why don't you just call it the morphogenesis of branch tissue? So, yeah, okay, that's fine. And I think it's a good title because I am going to talk about branch morphogenesis. And not only in tissues, but also in corals. So actually, branching morphogenesis is really ubiquitous in biological development. So there are a couple of examples here. So there's blood vessel development. This one doesn't really branch, a little bit over here. Then there is kidneys, which have a different way of branching morphogenesis. But as I will show, we think that in a way they might be related, or similar mechanisms might be responsible for the formation of branches in blood vessels and for the formation of branches in kidneys. It's just a slight twist of the mechanism. First, I'm going to talk about some old work that I did during my PhD on coral morphogenesis. And you will see again the same principles coming back in the other one. Thanks. And, well, branching morphogenesis also occurs in the formation of levination. I'm not going to talk about that. But if I did some work on that, if you want to hear that, please ask me later. And I really hope I can make it to the kidney stuff. So let's see. I have a lot of slides. So I won't be able to make to show them all. So basically, branch morphogenesis is an example of biological development. And I always like to show this slide because basically what does biological development do? It somehow decodes what we wrote, what is written in the DNA, and it translates that somehow into an organism, like for example the zebrafish. And the way how it does that, well, there's nothing, as you know, there's never, nowhere in the DNA it's written how many fingers my hand has, and that I'm bald, and et cetera, but it is there in an indirect way, and the way it's decoded is by steering the cells that are going to build the embryo. And this is the process that we want to understand. We want to understand how cells can self-organize and build an embryo. And the way we look at that is the following. If you zoom in a little bit into this process, and you see all these cells doing their own thing, and they act as if they're moving, seemingly independently. And if you see some kind of overall stream, but it looks as if each of these cells knows what it should do, and it's doing its own thing. But of course, they're not completely independent. As you can see in this nice experiment that was published a couple of years ago in Nature from the Meyer and the Stern group. So basically what they showed, they took these neural crest cells, and if you put them in the dish independently, then they undergo a random walk. But if you put them in the group and you follow again a cell, then you see that it will show a ballistic movement. And the reason it does that is by contact inhibition. So basically, the cell wants to move in all directions, but if it's touched by another cell, that direction is going to be inhibited. So it moves the other way. And then, just by this really simple rule, if then you put a couple of cells together, all cells will start moving like a wave. So I think this is a nice example how simple rules that individual cells follow can lead to complicated behavior.
Although there's something else happening, right? Because if I remember this experiment correctly, all the cells, they don't all scatter to instantly minimize their contact with every other cell. Instead, they go as a mass in one direction. So there are some cells in the middle that never escape contact with other cells.
Right, but if you would follow this rule, mm-hmm. because they would scatter instantly if they would just really have an enormous behavior. Mm-hmm. But if they were surrounded by other cells, they are all inhibited. Mm-hmm. And so they don't move. They're completely inhibited, so they don't move. So they first need to wait until one of the other cells mm-hmm. loses contact. And then that part of the membrane can start moving, and it will move away.
In this experiment, what happens eventually is that they all...
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Are there chemical gradients in the movie on the left?
No.
How do we know that?
I don't know. They just put the cells in a dish. So there could be chemical gradients over here, of course. Yeah, there could be. Yeah, they didn't put that in their explanation, but you don't need it for the explanation. But there could be.
Cells, so they were taken out of the place where they normally occur, which is in a group, in a pretty small, I don't know how to quantify it, a pretty small region of the body where it's not known that across the cells in situ there's a gradient of something instructive. There could be, but we don't know it.
So what we try to do in our work is not understand this process. What we try to do in our work is to understand how simple rules, that's simple agents like cells are following, how they translate into complicated patterns, and how these complicated patterns will then change the environment of the cell such that its behavior will change. And I think, again, in this case, this is a really nice example that indeed a cell can follow a simple rule, and this rule will include the signals from its environment. So the environment that it itself creates will change its own behavior.
So when you say contact inhibition, is it more than just excluded volume?
Yeah, it's an active process. It's really a signal that will inhibit the motility at that position of the cell. But I'm going to talk much more about contact inhibition later on. I first want to talk about a different process, let me first go through this slide. So basically what we try to understand is how can you go from simple behavior of individual cells or other biological entities, how can you go from there to output at the macro scale? So these are patterns, biological patterns, embryos, but in this case branches. And how will a change of the behavior of the individual entities, for example a genetic mutation or pharmaceutical treatment, how will such a change lead to a change of the collective? So in this way, these kind of models help analyze how collective behavior constructs morphology, but also how this morphology feeds back on the individuals. And so the first project that I applied this to was coral morphogenesis. So this is an example of one of our simulations, and that I kind of fancied up a little bit, or how do you say it? But basically, we're trying to understand how, from simple rules that individual polyps follow, you can get a branching colony. And so if you zoom in again a little bit into coral growth, you can understand that it's a really multi-scale process. So we have a coral colony, which is basically a skeleton on which you have thousands of small polyps. These polyps are somehow coupled together, and they are consisting of cells. And of course, the cells consist of a lot of things, and one of these things is the DNA that regulates what these cells do. And these cells do determines what the polyp does, and what the polyp does determines what the colony does, and the other way around. So we are representing this in our model in the following way. So we have a model of individual polyps, which in this case are just points on the surface, on a curved surface. Then, and all these levels interact with the environment. So then we have a model of the environment. So in this case, the Navier-Stokes equations that determine the flow distribution. This will determine how much food a polyp can eat, or how much other growth resources it can get. And this will determine how fast it will grow, how fast it will deposit skeleton on the underlying skeleton. And this together will then somehow lead to a shape, a three-dimensional shape.
So nutrients are assumed to be uniform everywhere, or there's not a separate equation for the nutrient?
Yeah, sorry, I just put the Navier-Stokes equations here as an illustration. But there is a separate equation, advection-diffusion equation.
Okay, and then the equation in the bottom left?
Actually, this is, sorry, I'm... This is the effects and fusion equation, sorry.
In the below the Navier-Stokes equations, there's a normal to the growth. N is the normal to the
growth. Yeah, I'm going to explain all of that later on.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just as an illustration of the different elements of our model. So how is the model built up? So first we have to look a little bit at the structure of the polar colony. So as I said, it's basically, we can see it as a big colony of individual polars. These things. And they all have tentacles, they can all eat on their own. So they can all act more or less independently. They live on a skeleton, and they can deposit new skeleton on top of the old skeleton. And at the same time, I said, well, they act as individuals, which are also coupled together, so they can also share food.
So each polyp is itself many cells?
And each polyp is many cells, yeah. Yeah. So it's,
Are you including the photosymbionts in this, or these ones?
And not in these models, but in newer models that my PhD supervisor, Jaap Kamel, is working on right now, they have included that. Yeah, but in these, the models that I'm going to explain you about today, there's no photosynthesis, no zooxanthellae. So indeed, these polyps make the coral grow, or make this coral skeleton grow. So they basically deposit skeleton on top of the old skeleton. And indeed, as a result, you can see in these corals, this is a big hemispherical, I think it's Montastria and Onaris, I'm not really sure. But you can basically see these kind of growth rings, if you cut it. And also what you can see is the trajectories of the polyps. Because all these black lines are paths that the polyps followed once the coral has been growing. So then, indeed what you can say is there are two ways the coral has to grow. So one way is by depositing calcium carbonate on top of the old skeleton, which we call skeletal growth. And the main limiting factors of that are energy, for example, from light by the zooxanthellae, or from organic nutrients, and the availability of resources, for example, dissolved inorganic carbon, or even the ability to get rid of waste products. And a second thing is that as these corals grow, you can already the skeleton grows, you can already see that the surface area is going to increase. So they need to be able to fill up that new area. And so this is a distinction that Barnes introduced a long time ago. So they also need to fill up that space by making new tissue. And it's thought that these two kinds of growth have different limitations. Well, so what did we put in this model? So we are considering the coral as a community of individual polyps. And although it's not entirely individual, because they can share nutrients, we still consider them at first as one simple colony. And we want to find a robust and simple and entirely local explanation for coral branching. So we really want to understand, can the structure of this colony explain already why the corals can branch? And then I already explained this, it's multi-scale, etc. And what we want to understand is how this variation in the properties of the individual polyps affects the morphology of the whole colony. So how is the model built up? Well, in a very simple way, we represent the coral by triangulated surface, and the nodes between the triangles represent the polyps. So then we want to calculate the flow field around this colony, and to do that we use a method that is called the Lattice-Boltzmann method. We basically you need to do this on a discretized grid. So the advantage of that is you can easily calculate flow fields around rather complicated morphologies. So we discretize this, and then we put it on a So we discretize this this shape. So we put it on a lattice in three dimensions. Then we can calculate flow fields. We did it on multiple computers that were relatively slow compared to the ones we have now. That's why we needed to do this. And then you get a distribution of nutrients. And we assume that these polyps are absorbing the nutrients by a little mouth that they have over here. So basically, we assume that each polyp has a certain height, and it sticks out a little bit from the surface and it pokes into the fluid. And from there, it can absorb nutrients. So then we know how much each polyp has eaten. Then we say, we put that into growth function that will say how much skeleton will be able to deposit depending on the amount of food it has eaten. And based on this, we can build a next layer. Yeah?
Where is the source of nutrients?
Okay, that's on my next slide, but basically we can vary that. But in this case, I think in all the simulations I'm going to show you, it's from the top. The one I showed on my title slide, it is coming from all sides. Or it wasn't the title slide, but the title slide of this part.
So there's no nutrient depletion in the bulk, it's buffered. In the simulation, you always have at infinity a constant background.
We basically assume in this, it depends a little bit on which boundary conditions we used, but in many simulations we assumed periodic boundary conditions. So it is as if you have an infinite reef with food coming from the top. But we have other simulations where we assumed an isolated coral, and then we had zero boundary conditions on the edge.
So in an actual reef, the food is coming from the top in the form of marine snow that's coming down, for example?
Or the assumption was basically that if you are in an infinite reef, and the food is, your neighbors are eating away all the food, right. So the only direction you get fresh water...
If you could get it, is from the top.
What is the actual food?
It depends. They eat organic nutrients, they eat little animals and krill, but they depend for most corals that we have in reefs near the coast. They are they depend for a large part on photosynthesis because they have intracellular algae called zooxanthellae. They are basically providing the polyps with photosynthesis.
And the growth-limiting process is the light?
In that case, it's light, but another thing is inorganic carbon. Okay. Recent experimental research has shown that it can also be the rate by which they can get rid of their oxygen. Because if they try to photosynthesize and there's lots of oxygen nearby and they cannot get rid of it, basically accumulates next to the coral surface. And this may also form fields that will limit the growth.
I'm just asking because here your motivation is that part of the morphogenesis is that there's some diffusional process that's
closing
it, right? And so that diffusional process would be diffusion of oxygen.
That would be either a diffusion of oxygen away from the coral, it would be dissolved inorganic carbon towards the oxygen, towards the colony, because that's what they need to photosynthesize and to make calcium carbonate.
And not that
or it could be food. So, for example, there are non-photosynthetic corals that would depend entirely on organic food.
And the assumption is that the photosynthetic symbiont is slave to the number of polyps that are growing.
I'm sorry?
You don't explicitly have complementary symbiotic organism that helps the coral.
Here we assume that this is not limiting. So the amount of light they receive is not limiting.
I just want to make sure that's good. So it's whatever it needs to be to help the polyps. The concentration of that.
So we are looking at a resource that's dissolved in the water and that the polyp somehow needs in order to make skeleton. And this can be anything.
And in practice, in an actual coral reef, the symbiont lives inside the polyp?
Inside the cells of the polyp.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Well, so we have a certain method to model resource transport. This is how we build the layers. So it's basically a triangulated surface where the nodes are representing the polyps. Then each polyp sticks out a little bit into the water. There it absorbs nutrients, and depending on how much it can eat, it can grow faster. So this will determine the length of this arrow, normal arrow. So it will determine the local thickness of the layer. Right? And in the simulations I'm going to show here, I'm not going to talk about flow, because in the method we used here, we couldn't reach high enough the clam number, so it didn't really matter. So I'm looking at the fusion-dominated growth. So indeed, we have periodic boundary conditions here, and the fluid coming from the top. But you can vary this in all kinds of different ways. And so we basically have a very minimal number of assumptions. So we just say there are polyps on the surface. They absorb food. And depending on the amount of food they can absorb, they will grow faster or slower.
And the rotation is just an artifact so we can see what's happening.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can look all around. Yeah. And the colors are the growth rate or the amount of absorption rate, basically. And so, of course, what you will see here looks very much like diffusion limited aggregation, for example. So basically what you get is all the tips that stick into fresh water, they still have access to a lot of food, and it's very hard for the food to reach between the branches, because then all the other polyps eat the food away. So you get depletion zones here. But so
this is what happens with actual corals, that the same species of coral, if you give it more nutrients, you will change the morphology?
Yeah. Okay. Or there's the idea that if you put them in more flow and higher flow rates, they grow more dense, etc. But the jury is still out on what causes that. But indeed, there's corals are highly plastic. But so you could say, well, this is entirely similar to diffusion limited aggregation. And but there is still one important difference, because if we so in this case, I said we have individual polyps that stick out into the water. If we do not do this, so if we just make the whole surface a sink, and then we just measure what is the gradient at each location, then it can still branch, but it's much more difficult. So we have to really make sure the fields are entirely in equilibrium, and then we grow again, and then very slowly it will start branching. So in this way, if we do it in this way, things branch much more easily. And why is that?
Is there an advantage to the triangulated structure as opposed to some other form?
I don't think it's necessarily the triangulated structure, but I think it's more the fact, and that's what I'm going to show in the next slide, the fact that if you put these polyps on a curved surface, right, then assuming individual polyps, you're introducing an extra curvature effect. Because if they are on a flat surface, you know, they're all standing side by side and they get a lot of competition from their neighbors. But if they are going to be on a positively curved surface, they are kind of fanning out, and so they receive less competition. Whereas if they are on a convex part of the surface, then they are kind of poking into each other, and they're really they get more competition from the neighbors.
And the colors on the previous slide were a proxy for growth rate or something?
Yeah, they were the growth rate or the amount of nutrients. They were actually the amount of nutrients that
that's
the polyps got.
Nutrient flux.
The nutrient flux.
Normal.
Absolutely.
Flux.
Yeah.
The colors mean.
Yeah. And by the way, this is a cross-section of the whole thing. You can see the individual growth layers. So, but if this is important in this model, then, so this introduces a curvature effect. Then also we should be able to reduce that curvature effect by placing the polyps further apart from one another. And so this is what we're trying to do. So what I did here is I'm increasingly placing these polyps further apart from one another. And what you can see is that the further we place them apart from each other, the more thick the branches will become. And indeed, it suggests that this what we call polyp fanning effect has a plays an important role in this branching process in our model.
And to just having a lower uptake rate per unit of area.
Is it similar to having a lower? Let me think. This is a thing we didn't test. Because in these models, at this moment, we assumed that all the polyps were really sinks.
So it is, right? If you reduce the number of, the density of polyps.
Then it reduces the total uptake rate. But your question is if you were to change to have the same uptake rate for, if you would have a reduced uptake rate for the individual polyps, would you still get?
Yeah. Well, you know, I tend to think about this diffusion limited aggregation, like
right. This
is a balance between diffusion and consumption.
Right. Exactly. Right?
So and if consumption dominates, then you have the finger-like structures. But if diffusion is very strong, then you have the
right.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
And so you wonder if this could be related.
I don't
think it's a good question. I'm not sure.
But these little black
it would be something we would have to test. But it's I won't do that because this is really too long ago. But it would be interesting.
Just a point of information. There's little black dots that we see decorating these structures. Those are the polyps.
Those are the polyps. Okay. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you put a to space them out more?
Yeah.
Did you put a cost of structure or cost of,
did
they have to absorb more nutrients to have a for the calcium carbonate or whatever?
Oh no, there's no. That would be a very interesting thing to do, but we didn't do that. We just looked at what happens if you place them further apart. And the reason was to reduce this curvature effect. But your question is a very interesting one. Could this also be due to the fact that if you that you basically reduce the effective absorption rate of the surface? And that's the thing. That's a very good point. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, we can discuss later.
Yeah, because indeed in diffusion limited aggregation, this is what would happen. It would have a very similar effect. Anyway, let's discuss this later. Yeah. And basically what we did here is to check that this was not a finite size effect, because it might also be that you're just basically reducing the resolution of your, of the, that we were just reducing the resolution of our triangulations. And that would suggest that if you would grow the coral twice as large, that it would still look statistically similar to one with fine spacing. But it didn't.
So this is just one type of coral, I guess.
There are many, many types of corals.
Some of them are completely...
Some of them are completely spherical, some of them are flat, and this is... So this will be closest to a coral called Madrasus mirabilis, which is a very branched coral. So the real coral I showed you in the beginning is Madrasus mirabilis.
But is it known why the fan shaped corals are approximately planar?
No. It's a very interesting question. It's also known, some of these ones, they orient perpendicular, I think, to the current, which is very interesting. Yeah, but I don't think it's known yet.
Also, I mean, that would give you better nutrient access to every cell.
Yeah,
so
yeah, exactly. Yeah, but then of course it's a nice question then of course is, this an entirely physical effect? Can you explain this with growth rates? Just because the branches that happen to move perpendicular to the flow direction, they happen to grow faster, or is this really an adaptive thing that you that the coral actively regulates? But it's a very interesting question. Yeah, and also how can yeah?
Is there a measured temperature gradient as the coral grows? Because some of these corals are huge, and they would shade sunshine, so there could be a significant temperature effect.
Yeah.
Photosynthesis gradient.
Sorry.
Or equivalent photosynthesis gradient.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. We haven't put it in, but what people, my PhD supervisor at the time, Jaap Kamel, has done is indeed includes shading effects. And then you see, well, basically what you see is that coral grows more upward.
Yeah.
And this one, before I move to the next topic, this is one thing I would like you to see. If you follow now these trajectories, this is basically cross section where we couple subsequent positions of the polyps. Well, first of all, you see they form this typical fanning shape that you also see in cross sections of actual coral skeletons. But also, what I like very much is that you get regions where the growth trajectories are diverging. So that's where new polyps get born. But there are also areas where trajectories are converging. Like for example here or here. So this is where the polyps die. So you might argue that even you get a new level selection in this kind of structure, because a polyp that will grow on one branch can never make it to another branch, because before it gets there, it will be squeezed between the two branches. So that means that, for example, if you would have a mutation of a polyp on one branch, that it also will never reach the other.
But the actual polyps branch, and that's a parameter in the simulation where you allow them to branch?
No, it's entirely emergent. So we don't have any rules that will...
Emergent property.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the polyps, they reproduce?
I think I kind of skipped over that. Let's see if it's still... Yeah. So it is an example. So we have three polyps over here. And they grow, and we assume here they're on a convex part of the surface. And after the growth, these polyps are getting pretty far from one another. And so we just have a rule that says if two polyps are too far from each other, we place a new polyp in the middle of it. So that's how the new polyps get born.
So there is a parameter that is how far apart before you...
How far apart before you introduce a new polyp, yes.
Do you tune that? Or how do you choose that parameter?
We just said if the distance is twice a base level, then we introduce one. Yeah.
And similarly, if they're converging.
If they converge and they reach half of the baseline, we fuse them. And the fusing is just because it's for computational reasons.
But putting that you can get really branches, short structures too. So there was a question about the density of polyps. But I guess you can get round shapes, but if you go the other way, you can get really branched and thin.
Well, if you do it the other way, which other way?
Increasing polyp density.
Yeah.
Then you got round shapes.
Right. Yeah, the other way around.
Then you get really fractal,
fractal. Yeah, but then of course at a certain moment you're going to be limited by the lattice of the flow simulation. So we didn't do that. But yeah, yeah. Yeah, because you're increasing the curvature effect. Yeah. Okay, there's one last thing I wanted to show. But if you know DLA, this is not going to be surprising. But for many coral biologists, it is surprising. So they go into the field, and they find two corals that are growing really close to one another. And together they form the shape of one colony. So from a distance you cannot see that this is one colony. But then if you move closer, it looks really, it appears they're really two different colonies. So this led people to say, for example, Rinkevich, a coral biologist from Israel, to say that these corals should communicate, that they are secreting some kind of hormone called an isomone that will organize the whole colony. And so we said, well, let's try what happens if you put two of these corals next together. And of course, I mean, and this is the reason is that a new depletion zone of food will appear between the two corals. And the result is that with these very simple rules, you get something that looks like one coral. And that seems as if it's communicating. Now, of course, it is communicating in a way. It's communicating via by competing for food. So you don't necessarily need to assume any active communication between these two colonies. But this is a thing if this appears in much simpler models, like DLA models. So, what I've showed you, in these polyp-oriented models, we see an effect that we could call polyp fanning, and this introduces, so the fact that polyps will fan out and on convex parts of the coral surface, hence receive less competition from one another, may drive this branching. And indeed, how close these polyps are packed, this influences the size of the branches, and this is indeed a prediction of the model. So for dense packing, we get finely branched objects, for coarse packing, thickly branched objects. And this I said. Anyway, so.
Another question about the previous statement you made.
Before we move to the
coral reefs form by accumulating polyps over a long period of time, right?
Yeah.
So what you said about inhibition of two polyps that are growing close by. Imagine you have a colony of such polyps that are growing close by. So does it mean that they will change the structure of the surface in a predictable way that you can actually? By sectioning a coral reef, you can actually see how in the past the corals have inhibited each other's growth and deposits have changed. So the convex and concave surfaces alternate. As you can imagine that if you have more growth, it will make the surface more concave than it used to be convex. So you'll see ripples.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. There's one effect that will kind of inhibit this. Because in order to really have this, to find these kinds of effects, you would also have to assume that all corals behave in the same way. But corals are a little bit more smart than that, because they will, if you have two different species of corals next to one another, they will actively attack one another. So
it's not just food inhibition.
It's also they will. So two different species will really hit one another with. I forget what are the names of these. Cells, the nether cells, what the things that make a jellyfish hurt. The harpoon, they have these little harpoons. If you touch them, and this is what the corals do to one another, just to overgrow each other. So, but perhaps within one species of coral is what you could see. All right. I would like to move to another topic, much more recent, which is angiogenesis. So angiogenesis is the growth of new blood vessels, and this is actually a process that is perfectly normal. It happens all through your life, For example, if you have a wound and it closes, then new blood vessels will grow in to provide the new tissue with oxygen and nutrients. But it also occurs in less favorable circumstances, for example, during cancer. And actually, it's the same response. So if you have a couple of cells that whose growth becomes unregulated, they will start forming a small colony of cells. In the middle of this colony, cells get hungry and they get hypoxic, they get a lack of oxygen. So as a natural, perfectly natural response to that, the cells will start producing all kinds of growth factors, including VEGF, which is vascular endothelial growth factor, which will move to nearby blood vessels and activate endothelial cells that are those are the cells that cover the inner walls of your blood vessel. They will become restless, motile, and crawl out and form a new blood vessel that will then provide the tumor with with oxygen and with food, such that it can start growing again. So what, of course, we would like to understand is how can you fine-tune or stop such blood vessel growth in order also to stop tumor growth. Well, of course, this is a very complicated process that we would like to simplify a little bit. And a very common way of simplifying this process is by isolating those endothelial cells and culturing them in a dish. And this is a typical culture. These are endothelial cells that you can obtain from umbilical cords of newborn babies. You can just wash them out and put them in a gel, which is called MetroGel. So it's a commercial product. And this gel will activate the cells, and they will crawl to one another and form a network. So our question was, how can we understand this? And of course, we did that using the same approach of cell, we call it now cell-based modeling, because we have cells instead of polyps. And again, we do the same thing. We try to understand what rules endothelial cells must follow in order to form a network. So we put in the behavior of the endothelial cells at the micro scale, and at the macroscopic scale, we get out tissue shapes, patterns, and then we try to understand how a change in the cell behavior will change the patterns. Just like in a coral model, we could change the distance between the polyps, or we could change the growth function, etc., and then study how it will affect coral morphogenesis. Well, so there are many ways of doing this. You can model cells as point particles on a lattice, off a lattice. Typically what we do is model these cells as collections of particles, such that we can also represent the shape of the cells, but also such that we can say that a cell on one end does something else than it does on the other end, which is often important, as for example, that I showed in the beginning of the neural crest cells, right? So a cell was touched on one end, and the other end was more or less acting independently, and it would move away as a result.
So can I just go back to it, just to make sure I understood that movie? The final result was having seeded it with a low density of cells. There you go.
Yeah.
Was a network with voids? Are there voids between the network?
Sorry about that. Okay, so here are the cells. These are individual endothelial cells.
Yes.
And they aggregate. You can see a little bit of the individual cells over here, and they form a network.
Are there cells?
These are the cells, and these are voids in the network.
Good. And are there cell divisions on the time scale that we're seeing?
Not. There are some cell divisions, but not significant on this time scale.
Not a lot of them.
Okay. No. I'm not sure if you could see any cell divisions. Yeah, there would be a couple, but it's not relevant.
And the void spacing is related to the initial seed density of cells?
No.
Universal void spacing?
But it will change over time. As you can see, the void spacing starts relatively fine-grained and will coarsen over time. And if you reduce the amount of cells, you at a certain moment you get a percolation transition, meaning that they will still form branches, but they won't reach one another anymore.
Thank you.
Well,
yeah.
I probably know the answer to this, but is there a connection between the coarsening of this network and the coarsening of
two-dimensional soap bubble films? Because this movie, of this picture right here, reminds me a lot of those two-dimensional movies.
But that's when then the individual bubbles grow, right? And there's gas going from one bubble to the other, and
right,
some
eventually
bubbles.
Eventually, those coursing.
There's no pressure in this.
Yeah.
In these voids, right? That is, in the two-dimensional soap bubble cases, the pressure is what governs the.
Yeah. We do have some answer to why this courses. So, but I don't think that answer is related to what happens in soap bubbles.
Sure.
Yeah.
It seems like cells attract other cells.
Yeah, so we think that cells attract other cells. So that's our first hypothesis. Thanks. Okay, so you've got a lot, sorry, yeah?
For those movies, just watching them, I was looking at those polygons, and I think they had at most 6 vertices. How many vertices can you actually get if you look at
We haven't specifically measured this, have we? No, but we could measure it. We still have some data sets of this, but it's typically 3, I think, 3 per.
They come together in threes, but then there's the number of sides of the polygon.
Yeah. Oh, right, that's what you mean. Sorry.
Yeah. If I'm looking at that one left. It's probably, I think it has about 6 vertices, and one can count, and you can see 4,
yeah.
5, 6. So
very interesting question. We've never looked at this.
So
yeah. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. Okay, you've heard a lot of stories about the cellular pulse model. Is everybody familiar with that? Have you all seen James' talk? So I don't need to go over this, right? You know about, you have the Hamiltonian, you have cells that are represented by multiple letter sites in the same state, and you have a component that describes cell adhesion, a component that describes volume conservation, and we minimize this Hamiltonian by simulating stochastic motility of cells, which they move by protruding and retracting sections of their membranes, and this we represent by letter site copies. So we apply these kind of copies, then we look at what the Hamiltonian does. If this minimizes the Hamiltonian, meaning that we get, for example, stronger adhesion to an adjacent cell, then we are going to accept it. But we also are going to accept sometimes changes that are going to reduce, increase the pattern energy to account for active motility of cells.
And the model has built into it that like cells adhere better to like cells?
And that's a parameter. So that is a parameter that you represent by the J, by the J. So J is a matrix,
right,
that represents the adhesion between all pairs of types of cells in your simulation.
So yellow could be adhering to red more weakly than yellow to yellow.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So as in this simulation here, we have 2 types of cells. So we say now that yellow adheres well to yellow and red adheres well to red. So they sort out. Now about halfway the simulation, we're changing one of these J values to say that the red cells have a very high energy with the medium, so they want to stay away from that. And as a result, the yellow cell starts surrounding the red cells. So we use these tools to start modeling blood vessel growth. And indeed, one of the hypotheses that was introduced a couple of years ago, 10 years ago, by the Luigi Preziosi group, they said they assumed that cells would secrete a chemoattractant and that would attract the other cells. And they showed this in the following way. So here you have an initial distribution of these UVACs, these endothelial cells seeded on a metrogel, and they assume that each of these cells is a point source of a chemoattractant, That would diffuse and degrade in the matrix. So the equation looks like this. And then we have a source term, and which is only true at the cells. So this will form exponential gradients around these point sources. And of course then, if you have higher densities of cells, you also get a higher concentration of your chemoattractants. And then if it follows, the trajectories of these cells over time is the initial condition, the initial position, the final position, you see that they move up these gradients of the chemoattractant. And then they develop the partial differential equation model that I'm not going to show here, which is related to the Burgers equations from astrophysics, and they show that these form networks, but they were unstable. And so this
is there shock waves, are there shocks that come out of this mapping onto Burgers?
Yeah, kind of strands of mass that are in the lattice, but eventually this will collapse into accumulations of all the mass. So the Burgers equations are gravitational equations. So we decided to do it in a normal way. And why? Because for two reasons. In the Burgers equations, you have Newtonian mechanics, meaning that if you apply a force, this will accelerate the cells. And in this kind of environment, this gel is a very viscous environment. So this creates other kinds of mechanics. It says that it creates overdone mechanics where the force is going to be proportional to the velocity. And this kind of mechanics is very well represented in the cellular pots model. And on top of that, we can also look at the role of stochasticity in this kind of system. So that's why we decided to look again at this problem. And to do that, we need to modify the cellular pots model a little bit. And we do that just by adding a partial differential equation on top of that, that is going to solve this equation over here. And it's discretized with the same grid spacing as the cellular pots model. So that means that in each of the lattice sides, you get a concentration, here represented with grayscale. And so we can make the source term dependent on the position of these cells. So where we have a cell, we have a source. Where we have medium, we don't have a source. And then we also want the cells to respond to the chemical concentration in the lattice. And we do this in the following way. It's an algorithm introduced by Nick Seville and Pauline Hoogweg to model Dictyostelium morphogenesis. So what they assumed is that if cells are protruding a pseudopod, they will do so more likely in the direction of a higher concentration of the chemoattractants. And the same is true for retraction. If they retract the pseudopod, and if the concentration were higher over here, they would do so with a higher probability. So that means now we have all the tools together to implement this hypothesis again. So we just assume that all cells are secreting a chemoattractant that is diffusing away and that is degrading, so you get exponential gradients around these cells, and they're attracted to one another, and you get maybe what you would expect, an accumulation of cells. And something, you know, if I were to stop the simulation over here, then I would have something like a network, but it's not stable.
And there's a surface tension built into this cellular pot.
Yes, this surface tension is there automatically.
And they form little circles and diffuse.
Although the settings are such in this case that the surface tension is very weak. There's actually a surface tension of zero.
What are
there's also going to be some surface tension nevertheless.
What are the iso contours?
Oh yeah, those are the iso lines of the chemical concentrations.
Of the secreted material.
Of the secreted.
It decays exponentially. But why does it decay exponentially when there's no cells out there in the open spaces, in the interstices? Why would it decay exponentially in that case?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Well, if I understand the model,
yeah.
There's some sort of attractant
mm-hmm.
secreted by every cell.
Yeah.
And then you had a decay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, what is the biological basis of that decay? It's just...
For example, neutralization by diffusing receptors, like VEGFR1 receptors.
That okay, can so just mop up the background of absorbers.
Yeah, or it can be the extracellular matrix that will bind the...
some sort of enzyme.
Yeah, an enzyme that breaks it down.
Not of itself, but...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, now I understand the confusion. Yeah. Yeah, so it's not necessarily cells that break it down, but it can be just enzymes that are in the extracellular.
But the scale of that screening length, of that exponential healing length or whatever,
yeah,
is known from experiment, or it could be anything?
There's
epsilon in your...
So there's a lot of... So it's the diffusion length is like this, right?
Yep.
So... there's a lot of discussion about this.
Right, and here it looks very small compared to the spacing between the
atoms
themselves.
Yeah, and if you take reported values of these diffusion coefficients for VGF, you take reported values of the epsilon over here,
our
gradients are way too steep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But there are all kinds of... So first of all, it's not known whether they really secrete VEGF or whether they secrete other growth factors. If they secrete VEGF, it's very likely that they're going to be trapped by the extracellular matrix, which would radically slow down the diffusion. So there are all... Or it would even increase the degradation. So there are all kinds of reasons to assume that... that it's not sufficient just to measure the diffusion of VGF in the watery solution.
Okay, and then there was a link scale in those nice experiments where everything formed this network with voids in between, and that was the width of the of the filamentous aggregations of cells.
Yeah.
And could that be related to L?
That is related to L. Okay. So if we let me move forward, and I can show. Yeah. So basically, so here we have a model that doesn't work, right? It's, if people know it, it's actually a cellular Potts implementation of the Keller-Siegel equations. So so we wondered, can we modify this model to have it make networks? And actually we can, and as I will show you, unfortunately it's very easy to do it. So we have a lot of different explanations now. So the first explanation, we were really happy, and now we have so many explanations that it becomes problematic. So, but the first explanation is the following. If we change the shape of these cells in such a way that they're elongated instead of round, then we get networks. And also what I like of these networks is that they have a very similar coarsening behavior. So they start off very fine grained, and they start coarsening over time. So the wavelength changes over time.
Do you have a tunable aspect ratio for the cells now?
Yep.
And you're just doing it in two dimensions for some... Well, it's on a dish.
It's on a dish, so it's reasonable to assume this is a two-dimensional process. The only thing is maybe in reality they could crawl over each other. Here they cannot do that.
And again, there's no cell division on the time scale.
No. We could do cell division, but here in this model we don't.
What was the difference between this model and the previous?
The cell shape. So we add one component to the Hamiltonian. Can you all see this? So basically we add another element, which is the following. So remember, we had this area constraint, now we also have a length constraint. And this length we can measure using the inertia tensors of the cells. So we can estimate it.
So which is the, I don't get the matter, but little L, let's say.
Little L is the actual area, is the actual length, sorry, as capital L is the target length.
And it bears no relation to the square root of D over epsilon.
Right, completely different.
No, it's completely different.
But the idea, the idea here is that you extract the largest. Does this correspond to the largest eigenvalue of the shape tensor?
Yes. So we have the inertia tensor, which is which you can construct from roll moments. So that's the sum of x squared, et cetera, et cetera. And that's those things we can keep track on while updating the cells. So we, in this way, we always have an efficient estimate of the length.
And you always take the largest.
Always take the largest eigenvalue.
Yeah. All
right. And so anyway, yeah. And there is a little problem that we also need to take care of. Sorry. Yeah.
I'm saying if you run this long enough, it also seems to coursing too far to be consistent with the nice voids and so forth.
Indeed.
But for a while, it looks better.
Yeah. And actually, we do think that in this case, this is going to stabilize. But we cannot know for sure, because we cannot do simulations for infinity. But we do think that if we run them quasi-infinitely, very long, they coarsen, they also, you know, they settle down on a particular wavelength.
But we know that the experimental system doesn't keep coarsening
that fall apart.
When metrogel is stable,
it will experimentally it will just fall apart. Yeah. So it will just die. The cells just die after a while. Yeah. They're actually not so happy in metrogel.
Do you need to perfuse them?
Sorry?
Do you need to perfuse the metrogel? Can you perfuse that?
That's replenishing the nutrients.
Possibly. Yeah. Possible, yeah. Yeah.
It's probably good.
We didn't do that. Did we do it in experiments? No. I've done some experiments with metrogel myself. But basically my task was to take them out of the incubator and put them under the microscope, take a picture, and that every hour, 24, or yeah, no, not every hour, but still long enough to get some lack of sleep after a while. But it was a lot of fun. But I didn't touch the actual cells.
But it looks like you're developing junctions which are always three-way junctions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nearly 120 degree, is that?
Yeah.
I mean, one has to wait, I guess, for some.
Yeah.
Is that understandable from the POTS point of view?
We haven't looked at it. It would be it's nice though that we don't have they orient along approximately 120 degrees angles on a square lattice. So that means we don't have a lot of trouble with lattice effects in this particular setting. But we did do other analyses, so that I would like to tell you more about right now, because my PhD student Marie Paul found that we don't even need the chemotaxis in this model, so it's just sufficient to have volume exclusion. So if you just put a lot of these cells together, elongated, they're close enough so they will touch, they will form networks. But with a little bit different dynamics, so so this is at the same time scale, so with chemotaxis they develop much more quickly and they will get a much bigger length scale. But this more simple model allowed us to understand a bit better why cell shape matters. So basically what we think happens is that, well, the cells will align with one another. So they will form elongated structures and orient their axis relative to one another. So that means that we can analyze maybe the system as if it were a liquid crystal with rod-shaped particles that are aligning with one another. So this allows us to define an orientational order parameter. So the first thing we have to define is tau. This is a function of the lattice site, and r, which is the radius. So we say, so at each lattice site, we take the mean orientations of all the cells on a disk of radius r.
probably not important, but that orientational litter parameter is appropriate for three dimensions, not two.
Really?
Yes.
Oops.
You want a two instead of a three.
Sorry?
That three, it would only average to zero in an isotropic medium in two dimensions if that three is replaced by, it may not be important, but that's a three-dimensional pneumatic order parameter that you...
Oops, we didn't catch that. The reviewers didn't hear. Oops, thank you. All right, so I will have a look at that. So this should be a two, you say?
Yes.
Okay. Oops. Okay. So anyway, so we have here an order parameter. It will become 1 if things are perfectly ordered, and will become 0 if put 2 there if it's completely unordered. Let me see. Yeah. So then if we look at how these networks are developing, is, well, a couple of things. First of all, the chemotaxis. So if we look at a local ordering, so with a disk RS20, then we see that the chemotaxis simulation really settles quickly on the ordering close to 1, and then it remains relatively stable. For the simulation without chemotaxis, it goes much, much slower. And then it still slowly seems to settle down. We have a ordering over larger scale. So this scale basically captures the side-by-side ordering of the cells. This scale also captures the cells in front and on the back of the cells. So then we see that with chemotaxis, this also goes fairly quickly. And for the simulations without chemotaxis, the ordering is really slowly, settles very slowly. But actually, it seems it doesn't really settle. I mean, here it intersects, but it might just go on. And then we look at the global ordering. Well, we see that the whole thing doesn't really reach an ordering because we have a network. Right. And so then we thought that what would be happening? So we thought that cells would locally orient to one another, and so for one cell to join an adjacent cluster, it's relatively easy because it can just easily rotate and then join it. But once a couple of cells have joined together, for the whole cluster to move around and to join an adjacent cluster is going to be fairly difficult because you have the whole cluster as it turns. And so to analyze this, what Magie did was again using this local ordering and plotting it on a movie. So here you see ordered domains separated by letter sites with a high value, a low value ordering parameter, which is where you have kind of lattice effects. So then what you can do is you can kind of use these borders to separate clusters and to look at the diffusion, the translational and the rotational diffusion of these clusters. The rotational diffusion doesn't really have any dependence on the translation diffusion doesn't really depend on the cluster size, but the rotational diffusion does in the following way. So, indeed we see here that for small clusters it's relatively easy to rotate. For bigger clusters, it becomes much more smaller. So what we think is indeed that initially you get a formation of a lot of locally ordered domains, and then that will still try to join up, but this joining is going to be much ever more slowly. So we think that eventually, without chemotaxis, the whole system will just evolve into a cluster of ordered cells. But we never get there because the process is going much more, ever more slowly. And this is what we call arrested arrested dynamics.
So S sub 0 means what in your...
It means that there's no local ordering. So in this case, S has a value of 0 because the cells are oriented in one direction over here and in another direction over there. So they separate. This way we can separate locally ordered clusters.
If I understand correctly, if you were to use the correct two-dimensional S rather than the one that you're using, your 0 would be at a different angle.
Yeah, but this is not, I think we're somewhere there. So probably if we were to use the right value,
so which right when you go with 0, is that the idea?
With the formula that you showed and two dimensions, I don't see how it could be less than a half.
We have,
you can't average a cosine squared and get anything less than
that. I will have a look at this. I mean, this is...
You want to change that 3 to a 2.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you. Yeah, this is a... we were kind of new to the liquid crystal theory, and we totally missed that. Yeah. That is, but indeed we can put a certain threshold over here to separate those clusters, and it's not going to be 0 or close to 0. I'd have to ask Margit exactly what threshold she used.
Well, if the average of cosine squared was a half,
right,
then you get 0. Is that right?
It was the right order parameter, but if it's 3 cosine squared minus 1, it couldn't be less than a half.
No, but he has a 1 half in front of the whole thing.
That's true.
So that would be 1/4, right?
Yes.
So maybe that's why you're seeing 0.25.
Right, exactly.
Because you're only getting down to 0.5.
Keep going. There.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are getting close. Yeah,
That's really zero.
This is why the KIDP is so.
Yeah, we can. Thank you. I mean, we can't correct this this reference anymore. We can correct this one. So. Thank you.
Yeah. That doesn't explain why you're getting close. So, well, maybe this, you would get closer to one. Is that possible? Oh.
Yeah,
because
three
minus
1 over 2.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
It actually should be getting close.
Okay. Oh, well, opens up a whole lot of new questions. Thanks. Okay, so anyway, I promise you I would show you other mechanisms. And yet other mechanisms and other mechanisms. And one of these other mechanisms is the following. And that is based on contact inhibition. And the idea here is that... in the initial model, we assumed that cells would secrete a chemoattractant and that all the membranes of the cells would respond to that chemoattractant in the same way. Whereas, in fact, we know that chemoattractants may have a context-dependent effect, or signals in general. And an example of that is the following. If you have VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, and it binds to VEGFR2, on a cell ECM interface, this will activate the ERK-MAPK pathway, which will make the cell more dynamic and often leads to proliferation. However, if you bind the same signal on a cell interface, then this due to binding with the cadherin, this leads to AKT activation and survival. So this is what makes cells grow until confluency in the cell culture. So we translated this idea in the following way, is that we said now the cells are no longer going to feel the chemoattractant on all their membranes, but they're only going to feel them on the cell ECM membranes, and on the cell membranes are going to be insensitive. And so by only making this change and keeping the rest of the model the same, this is what you get. So again, you get networks. They have slightly different properties. They don't have this strong coarsening behavior that you saw in the other. And what you do get is a fusion of these lacunae and also splitting of lacunae. Like, I think it happens over here in a minute. Come on. Yeah, there's one. And I think this one is even, it's going to split or almost going to split. Yeah. Come on. it was somewhere else. Anyway, believe me, they will split. So you get a kind of dynamic equilibrium of closing of lacunae and formation of new, splitting of existing lacunae. And a funny thing of this mechanism, and by the way, it also happens for the cell elongation mechanism, is that the same mechanism can also form sprouts. Here you have... and this kind of starting from a blob makes it much easier to analyze.
Okay, so what's happening? There's no elongation here.
No, there's no elongation here. We go back to round cells. So we could test both mechanisms together, but we want to separate the two effects.
So following up on that, so does the area of those lacunae depend on the cell size, whether the cells are round or elongated?
No. Depends on the diffusion length. Because even if we were, at a certain moment you would say it starts to depend, but even if we were to use really large cells, sometimes the cells, even themselves, start to buckle. So there are some other phenomena that depend on the cell size, but the size of the lacunae is dominated by the diffusion length. So what happens here? So the first idea we had is, well, let's look at one cell on a blob of on the surface of a blob of cells. So this, if we make a cross section here, what we get is a normal distribution of the cuboid fractal. How far am I in time?
You could go another 20 minutes.
Oops.
Would you like to pause and start a new subject later, or?
Yeah, I was wondering. I was hoping to get to a different topic.
You want to jump to that topic?
Let me jump to that topic,
okay.
Because otherwise there's going to be too much overlap of my
okay.
Friday talk.
Okay.
And I feel like I'm telling the same story over and over again. But okay. Oh yeah. Okay. Sorry, Andras, but I will show you some kidney models. Okay. So. So the mechanism I just showed you and the mechanism I was about to show you is on assumes that cells are attracted to one another by chemotaxis. And there are a number of problems with that hypothesis, namely that it's not known whether cells do actually secrete something like VEGF. There's a lot of discussion, sometimes they do, and then it's thought that they might secrete it because this is just a natural response for all cells that get hypoxic, etc. So then it might secrete another chemoattractant. So it's not really known, and there are loads of other hypotheses about it. But it's also known that the property of the environment that the cells live in, and that's the extracellular matrix, this is all kinds of stuff that cells produce and which they live in, that the properties of that gel, also like metrogel, will determine the also the sizes of these networks. And this has, as recent people have started hypothesizing that maybe cells are not attracted to one another by a chemotactic gradient, but they might be attracted by other things like forces applied in the matrix, or even signals that are just dropped in the extracellular matrix and that are not diffusible. So we started to, this made us realize that we should really have a better understanding of how cells are interacting with the extracellular matrix, and that we should also have better models of the extracellular matrix. And what I'm going to show you now is an explorative study of how a signaling via the extracellular matrix might contribute to angiogenesis. First, I'm going to show model of the ECM as a medium for chemical communication. And if I still have time, I'm also going to show you some results of the extracellular matrix as a medium for mechanical communication. So our question was, how can cell ECM interactions help coordinate cell behavior during angiogenesis? And so basically what we did, so this is work by Josephine Doubt, who was a master's student of my group. So what we're going to do is combine a series of experimentally plausible assumptions on cell behavior. And in this case, we do include proliferation. We have chemotaxis, but this time chemotaxis towards the tumor. So it's a long-range chemical signal. We assume the cells are secreting enzymes that will degrade the extracellular matrix. And there are two mechanisms by which they can respond to the density of the extracellular matrix. So we are now going to put these assumptions one by one in the model. So the model setup is as follows. We assume there is a tumor, and we assume here is a blood vessel. We also assume that the blood vessel has already been activated, and it has already poked a small hole in its basal membrane. And we do this just to make sure that we only get one vessel. We can leave away this basal membrane, and it will still have similar behavior, but you just get more of these sprouts. So we are going to put in one by one our model assumptions. So the first thing we have is just a basic cellular POTS model. And what you can see is just by the pressure that's built up in this vessel, if you poke a little hole, it will form a little blob of cells. So then the next thing we assumed is that the tumor is secreting an isoform of VEGF that will form long-range gradients. And as a result, this blob of cells will become attracted by this gradient, and it will stretch. So far it's very straightforward. So then we make a further assumption. We assume it's known that cells, the velocity of cells can depend on the local concentration of the extracellular matrix. And this is called haptokinesis. So this haptokinesis says that there is an optimal density of the ECM at which cells move fastest. And if there is a lower concentration, they will move more slowly because they cannot get any grip on that, on the extracellular matrix. If we have a higher concentration, it means they cannot move through it. They will be too strongly attached to the extracellular matrix in order to move, for them to move. So what we do here, we have a simple assumption, haptokinesis. This is really entirely phenomenological. And we just say that the probability that they can make a pseudopod will depend on the local concentration of this ECM. And so if we have an optimal concentration, there's a high probability they will do it. And if there's a non-optimal concentration, we're basically going to suppress this motility. And so then if we again do the same thing, we put in some of this ECM, which is shown here by the grayscale, then we can see that, not much happens, because the blob, the motion of the blob is going to be inhibited by non-optimal ECM concentration. So now we can add further hypotheses, namely proteolysis. So now the cells are going to secrete proteolytic enzymes like MMPs that are going to degrade the extracellular matrix and in this way bring it more closely to an optimal concentration. And at the same time, they're still going to be attracted by the long-range chemoattractant. So what you can see now is that they start digging a hole, poking a hole through the chemoattractant, through the ECM, and in this way they can move to the ECM. And also by poking a hole, we also make a path for the other cells that is more easy to follow. So the other cells will just follow them. But since we don't have sufficient cells, these blobs of cells will break loose of the parent vessel and move independently. So next thing we needed is proliferation. And we implemented by what we assume is that the cells, the cell division rate will depend, cells will divide if they're not going to be contact inhibited by adjacent cells. So that means that the cells that are closest to the ECM, and also the cells, for example, also the cells at the tips, they have the highest proliferation rate because they have the most contact with the ECM. And then what you get is a nice sprout that automatically splits, again, without making any assumptions on the splitting rules. And now you can start playing around with this. And for example, one thing that just been added is having haptotaxis, which means that cells will move to higher concentrations of the ECM. And in this way, there is, on top of the attraction towards the top, there's also going to be a sideways attraction further into fresh areas of the ECM. So you have a kind of two counteracting things. On the one hand, you have haptokinesis that wants to keep the cells on tracks of optimal concentration. On the other hand, you have haptotaxis that will attract the cells to higher concentrations. And in this way, the cells will spread out, and it will be much more easy for them to branch out. So now, if we put all of that together. The paper is almost out. Well, you get something like this. So it's really, that's why I call it an explorative study. It's really to show how an indirect signal between cells, so what sometimes people also call in insect communities, studies of self-organization of insect communities, they call the stigmergy, how such a stigmergic signal can act to coordinate the behavior of a whole sprout. And of course, then you can start playing with this kind of model. For example, increase the haptotactic strength, and then indeed you see that the cells have a preference for moving into fresh ECM, and they will spread out more and be less dominated by this VGF gradient. You can have all kinds of other studies, compare those with experiments where you knock out the amount of MMPs. And indeed, as I said, so this has this looks very much like what people have proposed in ant colony models. The only difference here is that the cells are degrading their environment, and in this way signaling to other cells, oh, this is a good place to walk for you. And this could be entirely mechanical. Whereas in ant colony models, like for example this by de Neuboer, they assume that cells are that the ants are secreting or are depositing pheromones that the other ants will follow. So I still have a little bit of time. I would like to move on to a model of mechanical communication. So this is work by postdoc former postdoc in our group, René van Oers, who has looked at mechanical interactions between cells and the extracellular matrix. And again, what we want to do in this model, we want to have a multiscale model where the model behaves correctly at a couple of scales. So we first want to have a model where the single cell behaves in an experimentally plausible way. Then we want that cell pair respond to one another in an experimentally plausible way. And then we want that the cell collective behaves in a plausible way. And the following thing we want, first for single cell behavior, we want that the cells align parallel to an exogenous mechanical strain. Then we want that the cells are also able to generate strains themselves. And then we want that cells are going to receive feedback from that. So they are going to apply strains on the matrix and receive feedback from those strains, respond to those strains, so you get a feedback loop. Well, so this is an example of an experiment where this is work by Daisy van der Schaft in Eindhoven, where she took a collagen scaffold, she plated out endothelial cells on that, she applies an external strain but before plating the cells out, and then you see that the cells will align relative to the strain, along the strain, parallel to the strain. Well, so how can we simulate that in the cell of plots model? Well, it's again a hybrid model. So we have a finite element model, which describes the strains in the matrix with linear elastic assumptions. And then we assume that the cells will extend more easily along the strain in this model in the following way, and there is a threshold in there. So for low strains, you don't really respond to it. For stronger strains, you will respond at the maximum rate. And then this is what you get. So this is the degree of stretch. And so you can see for a little bit of stretch, the cells are not really elongating relative to that, but for more strains, stress, they're elongating much more. And also you will see that they follow the orientation of that stretch. So that first part of the model is in place. So then I said the second part of the model should be that the cells are able to exert forces on the matrix and generate strains. And this is what we're doing here. So this is an experiment by Cynthia Reinhardt King. And what she did is tracked the force microscopy. Basically what you can do, they put fluorescent spheres in the matrix, and they looked at the displacements of these spheres in response to the forces that the cells are applying to the matrix. And then you can get these kind of displacement vectors. And what you can see is that these forces are typically directed towards the center of the cell, so they're really pulling on the matrix. Well, this has been proposed in a model of a couple of years ago, where Lemon and Romer, where they also observed that cells are pulling on the matrix towards the center, and they could model this very well by assuming that all the nodes in the cell, all the points in the cell, would apply a force on one another that is proportional to the distance between those two points. And this means that if you have a couple of cells, a part of the cell that is further away from the rest of the cell will pull on that part with a much higher strength. More or less to pull it back, it seems. So this is what René implemented in this model. You can show that it's the same as assuming a force of all the boundary nodes to the center. And then this is what you get. So the blue arrows show the strains in the finite element model, and the red arrows show the force that the cells are applying on that matrix. And you can see that further points of the cell that are further apart are pulling harder on the matrix, and this creates larger strains. So the strain field now follows the shape of the cells. So what we do not actually model is the real displacement of the cells because of that. So the next thing I promised is to have feedback between the matrix and the cell shape. And indeed, if you so what we wanted to capture is more or less this kind of behavior. So if a cell lives on a very soft matrix, it will contract, it will pull the matrix, and as a result, it will contract. If you have a very stiff matrix, it will pull on the matrix, and as a result, it will itself spread. So that's what we have here. And on intermediate stiffnesses, you will get an instability, and as a result, it elongates. And indeed, By putting both elements together, you can capture this behavior in the model. So again, by really simple rules. So then the next thing is, so now we have the single cell behavior, captured the single cell behavior correctly. Now we want to capture the interactions between cell pairs. And there are actually two kinds of behaviors we want to capture. The first kind of behavior is the following, shown by Cynthia Reinhardt-King. Basically, what she found is that if you put two endothelial cells very close together on the matrix, and the matrix is soft, these cells will move, will kind of join up and stay together, like here. If you do the same thing on a stiff matrix, they will move away from one another. And if you do this on an intermediate matrix of intermediate stiffness, they will move together, touch one another, and pull back and move, touch one each other again. So they make a couple of contacts after each other.
How do they control the softness or the matrix?
I think they do it. I'm not really sure, but I think they do it in a way that will not change the number of epitopes. So I think it's by adding maybe agar or something like that. But really only changing the stiffness. But I'd have to check that, to double check that. So now we have again exactly the same assumptions, but now we put two cells together in an intermediate matrix. And what you see is if these cells are approaching one another, they will create a strain between one another and a line along that strain, move along the strain. And this will create a behavior that looks very much like this touching behavior at matrices of intermediate stiffness. And also you get a second effect, which is the following, is that this is modeled and observed by Bischoffs and Schwartz, is that if you put two cells together, they will apply the strain on one another and they will also start aligning. So they will start moving in the same direction. And this is also reproduced by this set of really simple rules. And the other thing is this touching behavior. Oh, so this is an overview of how this depends on the matrix stiffness.
The initial condition where it's circular cells?
Yeah. Yeah, typically these are circular cells, or typically we grow them with an Eden growth algorithm.
And why did they become the longest?
In this case, by the way, it's done by the surface area.
Why didn't they stay circular?
Why didn't they stay circular? Why do they elongate? Yeah, this has.
You don't have this term, right?
This has to do with the little fudge factor in the model that I have to admit, and this I showed in the beginning. That's this threshold behavior.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if this is realistic. So it means, and this also determines the location of this of the switch, also determines where the matrix is supposed to be intermediate, right? Because if you would move this,
that's applied to,
it's a sigmoid function that determines how likely the cell is going to be. How likely the cell is going to protrude a pseudopod along the strain. So if we do this, so this is the an extra, an addition to the Hamiltonian at the moment of copying. So if it moves along the strain, it will be more likely to do that. And this is this also depends on the sigmoid function over here. So if there is a little strain in that direction, it won't matter. If there's much more strain, it will respond to it. And this, in this way, you can get at, if you're just at the stiffness that is in between at this region, then you can get an instability where the cell moves in a particular direction, then starts applying a little bit more strain on that direction, it moves more easily there, it elongates, the forces increase, etc., etc. So then it elongates.
So F is, you wrote F of epsilon, but you mean F is a function of the strain?
F,
what is, no, epsilon is the strain.
F, epsilon is a string, but this should be epsilon e. So there's another. So this is the string, and this is what we call the perceived string. So the perceived ECM stiffness.
I see. Okay.
So we don't have real strain stiffening in the matrix because this is a very expensive thing to calculate. We are currently working on it. The simulations become terribly slow. So what we did in this simulation is assume linear elastic materials and say that if the strain would become higher, the cells would perceive more stiffness. And this then goes into this function. Sorry, I forgot to explain that.
Stress here is proportional to strain?
In linear, that's the thing we want to simulate. So in linear elastic materials, or an ideal elastic material, stress is proportional to strain. In a less ideal materials, just think of a rubber band, you pull it, but you cannot keep pulling it, the strain won't continue. At a certain moment, you're reaching the end, and it's stiffening. So, and this is also a property that the ECM has. So if you pull it a little bit, it will behave more or less linearly, but if you pull it more, at a certain moment, it will stiffen as a result of that. For example, because collagen fibers are then stretched to their full extent, and they keep the material from extending further.
Right.
And this is a thing you can simulate with finite element methods, but it's very expensive. And so that's to keep these simulations tractable. We choose them. At this moment, we chose to use linear elastic assumptions.
I guess my question is, even in the linear assumption, there's a tensor that relates strain to stress, right?
Yeah.
Is that?
And that, yeah.
In here also?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But what I mean is that the strain, that the magnitude of the strain is going to be dependent on the, okay. It's going to be linear proportional to the magnitude of the strain.
And that's your assumption.
Yeah, that's what the linear elastic assumption.
All right.
Okay, so now we have the behavior for a single cell, right? With indeed this, the threshold behavior, which is going to be an important parameter. But basically, what we did it to, in order to be able to capture the phenomenology of single cells, and so we can capture the phenomenology of single cells and also those of interacting cell pairs. So now we wonder if this is sufficient also to reproduce the behavior of cell collectors. And indeed it is. So if we place together a couple of cells on the lattice, here you can see the strains, we only display them, then they organize into networks. And this is because the cells are going to align again. And they form local clusters of aligned cells. But in this case, unlike the first elongation model, the cells are aligning head to tail rather than side by side. Well, then, of course, the compliance is going to matter. And the exact crossover between this is going to depend on this function f. And also, it's sufficient to produce sprouting from a spheroid. And some biologists like this model much better than the original model we had for spheroid sprouting, because in spheroids, typically what you see is a couple of branches that move out, that really radiate out from the sprout, instead of our model where they immediately transform themselves into a network. All right. right, so I think it's time for, time for coffee, and that's why this is my conclusion slide.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so this is the conclusion for this. This is basically what I just told you, and then I could still philosophize about how do we deal with all these different explanations for the same phenomenon. Because it's all very nice that we can explain this phenomenon, but we can explain it in too many ways. So now we will have to find a way to choose one that is most, or choose a combination of some of them that is going to best explain the experimental data. And these are the acknowledgements of this work, and also acknowledgements for the for the choral work. Jaap Kaandorp, Albert Hoekstra, and Peter Sloot of the University of Amsterdam.
Thank you. So, since we don't, if there's any questions, let's just take a couple minutes of questions. I think we do have time for that. I should point out that you're giving a talk on Friday in the math department.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you'll talk about some of the things that you didn't get to hear.
No, unfortunately, I am going to talk about the ECM stuff.
Okay, all right.
That's what I didn't get to the last time.
Okay, I see, okay. Yeah. So
if you want to know more about the kidney stuff, you can
talk great. And that's, what time is that talk?
That's going to be at 3.
3 p.m. in South Hall.
Yeah.
Which is two-thirds of the way across the campus, roughly speaking. So, if you just head west, you'll hit South Hall, right? It's past the Arbor, where there's like a food area in the middle of the campus called the Arbor, I think. It's just past that. Okay, let's see. Are there other questions? Great. I don't think I have any other announcements other than there's no cookies and tea today because of the physics colloquium, which is in Broida. And the cookies and tea start in about 15 minutes, so you have some time. And the talk today is about Higgs bosons and superconductors, which doesn't really mean Higgs bosons. It means things like Higgs bosons. Okay. All right. Let's thank Roland again. Thank you.